you. My name is June. I'm an alcoholic. And, oh good, I'm glad somebody left their Kleenex up here. I'm going to need it. Wow. Am I doing okay there? Thank you. Thank you all so much for letting me be a part of this weekend. The last time I was at a live conference, I was with Renee and the guys, that gang back there. And so it's been a couple of years. And it's just been wonderful. And to listen to you guys share, and I haven't been able to find Corey, so I don't know, you know, if she left or not. But, you know, that was the one person I couldn't find to tell her. And so I just want to thank you so much for letting me be a part of this weekend, for all the things that you shared. I was reading in the 12 and 12 last night. I'm supposed to talk on step 12, and I'll try to, although I always like to do that disclaimer, which is that I am kind of like the dog in a Disney film. And if I see a squirrel, I just go. And I was thinking about it last night when I was with Renee and that gang over there. I was saying something, you know, profound. And I said, you know, and three of the most important things, you know, and then I said one and told a little story. And then I said two and told a little story. And then went on with something, and then this woman raised her hand, and I said, yes, and she said, what was three? And I'm like, oh, yeah. So that's going to happen today. And you know, and it goes on and on. And already, see, I just forgot why I even started with that. But it was talking about when I was reading the 12 and 12 last night again in step 12. It was talking about the many ways that we practice step 12. And one of the important ones is that we listen. What good would it be if we had a conference and so many of these amazing speakers that we had this weekend and nobody was here? You know, and I've really, really come to see more and more these last number of years, in particular with Zoom, which I am so grateful for. The importance of showing up and being there to listen. You know, Diana and I, we share a Zoom home group. And we've gone to a bunch of countries with our group. And sometimes we go wherever someone else is going from our group that's going to talk, just like we would back in the day when we used to meet in person while Zoom was happening. And quite honestly, some of the people are maybe they're not that good a speaker. Maybe they're a little slow or a little boring. I mean, whatever it is. But we go and we support them, you know. And one of the great things, you know, that I have learned over the years many, many times is I was taught to never leave a meeting. And I don't believe I ever have. I have wanted to. And I see why that's a very slippery slope. Now, of course, I've left a meeting if there was a medical emergency or if I had a work thing and I could only stay for half. And I don't even like to do that. I don't like to go to half. But my sponsor told me that sometimes that was all I could get to at different times. I needed to go there, you know. But, I watched, you know, again, people learning kind of manners on Zoom, you know, although there's a little bit more teaching that could be done. I've seen things on Zoom that I still can't quite get out of my mind. But the idea of being there, I look for those little squares. We have an amazing member of our home group, Joan. And Joan is going to celebrate 65 years. June 15th, and she is 90 years old, and she has had a spiritual awakening times 10 because of Zoom, because she's had health issues, and she wouldn't have been able to go a lot of the places, and she's been to Iran and Ireland and Israel and all over the place with Zoom, and I get the privilege of going to take her lunch
on her birthday. And that's part of why I'm wearing this mask, because she can't go out or be around people, and I'm going to be really, really careful as best I can, you know, to be able to show up for her. And so Joan getting sober in 1957 means that she's from the first generation of people to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I consider a generation, I looked it up, because how would I know, you know, but I did it, I looked it up a number of years ago. And a generation is generally accepted as 25 years. And so Joan got sober when Alcoholics Anonymous was 22 years old. I consider myself and a number of the speakers, including Mildred this morning, to have gotten sober in the second generation of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that those of you who are getting sober right now would be considered in the fourth generation of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I'm kind of mentioning that is that, you know, I think we all sometimes forget a couple of things. First of all, we forget how young Alcoholics Anonymous is in the context of the world. And so that means that actually, when Mildred was born, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist yet. That many of us have family members who, when they were born, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist yet. I happen to believe I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with anybody about it after the meeting. But it's what I believe. For generations, alcohol has been a problem in my family. My grandfather was killed at 46 years old. He was the drunk driver. He was killed along with people in his car and along with people in another car over in Ireland. When he was killed at 46 years old, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist. He left my grandmother, widowed with 13 children. One of them was my father. And when my father was born, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist. And my father was going to go on. I never met my father. My mom left him when I was 1 1/2. He left Canada and I was moved to California. But my father, according to his best friend, drank himself to death in a hotel before he was 50 years old. And when he was born, Alcoholics Anonymous didn't even exist yet. When my mother was born, Alcoholics Anonymous was not even 1 year old yet. And my mother was going to be a person who was going to be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for over 40 years with varying periods of sobriety. And I happen to have been born in a time where Alcoholics Anonymous exists. You know, there's an old book, and I've never read it. I just read titles. But it's like everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten. And I didn't read it. I read pages of it. But everything I ever needed to know I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to remember, and I kind of got that squirrel thing, but I always like to remember when I share like this that I want to be sure to tell you the two most important things that I will say no matter how many minutes I am up here. Because even today, I can't always listen to everything that the speaker is saying. They go on and on sometimes, and I have to think about me. So that was definitely true when I was newer. So in case you're one of the people like me today or are newer, I'm going to say the very most important things right now. So you don't even have to pay attention to a lot of the other things because you've already heard all the great things this weekend. And the number one most important thing that I will tell you is that I am not an authority or an expert on alcoholism, on Alcoholics Anonymous, on any step, on any page in the Big Book, on anything we could possibly be sharing about today. I am just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the second most important thing that I always try to remember to say, you know, over the years, people come to Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of different ways. They come to Alcoholics Anonymous more and more over the years, I have found, differently than when they did when I first got sober. I don't think it matters how many. anyone gets to Alcoholics Anonymous, be it a family member, a priest, a rabbi, a friend, a, you know, a doctor, a judge, you know, or a facility of some kind, you know. It doesn't really matter how anybody gets here, but because people come here in so many different ways, particularly more and more in the last several years, I want to be very clear about what I think is so important, and that is Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. If Alcoholics Anonymous had not been free, I could not have come. And if it hadn't stayed free, I could not have stayed. I was over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could afford to put a dollar in the basket during the seventh tradition on anything like a regular basis. And I have not been able to always put a dollar in the basket since I was 10 years sober. This is not about money. And that's really important to me, you know, that you know that. Somebody was sharing at a group, you know, a few years ago back home, and they said they were in a treatment center that their insurance was paying for. And they'd gone in, I think, on a Saturday. And on Sunday, the facility, the hospital or whatever, you know, they were saying, okay, you know, everybody line up. We're going to the AA meeting. The vans are over here. Everybody line up. And this man said, I went to the payphone and I called my insurance company because I didn't know if AA, going to an AA meeting, would be included in the price of what they were going to pay. And so he didn't go, you know. So I like to be sure that everybody knows Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. That being said, like Debbie mentioned last night, it's very important. I really encourage all the people that I sponsor or work with to become self-supporting and, of course, to support Alcoholics Anonymous in whatever ways they can. But sometimes it's not by money. And for that 10 years that I couldn't support Alcoholics Anonymous by money, I did a lot of service. And I didn't know that I was the one being overpaid. Because I always did more than a dollar's worth of work because I felt like such a loser in AA for so long. Everybody else was, you know, buying their sponsor dinner, you know, buying their sponsor a car. I'm just kidding. But, you know, I mean, you know, whatever. And I would come to conferences like this, and I couldn't afford registration. Somebody either bought me registration, or my sponsor, what she usually did was she'd sit me at the table, I think apparently working with someone like you, or Gail, who would give me a job. And I'd sit there for hours, doing whatever they told me to do, and then I'd get to go to the meetings. And so in the foreword to the 12 and 12, it's one of my favorite lines of all our literature, it says that the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, these steps, and I include the traditions and the concepts for me, but these principles are designed to allow the sufferer to be free from the compulsion to drink and to be happily and usefully whole. It's like, wow, I love that happily is in there. You know, it's really important to me that it's in there. And I saw so much joy and so much happiness, you know, this weekend. And I was thinking a lot about Amanda and the 12-step work that she did this weekend in so many different ways. You know, like she was wearing her sobriety. And so was so many of you as I walked around watching, you know. And I also thought I heard this other woman share one time, and she was sharing, and she said, you know, I'd been sober for a while, and some things were going on, and, you know, my sponsor came up to me, and they said, you know, you've lost your sparkle, and we got to do some work. We got to get your sparkle. Well, thankfully, at least this weekend, Amanda hasn't lost her sparkle. Thank you for your sparkle. So, where will I go here for a minute? It talks about in the first line of the 12 and 12, step 12, the joy of living is our theme. And this has been such an amazing journey. I'll tell you, it doesn't matter how many minutes you gave me. I can't possibly tell you where I've come from, what has happened, and what it's like now in any kind of detail at all. So again, I'm just going to kind of jump around. I have a few stories and things that I'd like to share that have been really important to me. But one thing I have to say, and I can't remember her name, and I'm looking for her over there. So I'll just say this, and hopefully she's here still. There was a woman over here. She's from Tallahassee, Florida, and she just came up to me and she asked me where the speaker's sponsor was. And the speaker's sponsors are back there, right back there, I think, in that row. So if you want to go find them, because I know you had something important that you wanted to share with them. Okay, that was in my mind there. Sorry. I think that... I'm going to just, like I said, I'm going to jump around first before I tell you too many of my story. You know, Chuck C. used to talk about the fact that the ego is the burr under the saddle. It's going to be the thing that's going to cause us so much discomfort that it's going to make us do some work along the way. And I've had a lot of work that I've, you know, needed, and I've had a lot of burrs under my saddle. And I love when people share different stories about how they did things purely out of ego, and yet how it made a difference. So for me, one of them was, I went to 21 meetings a week when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did that for 2.5 years. And I didn't do that because I wanted to get a gold star in AA. I had no place to go that was indoors. So it wasn't like I was going to stay home and watch TV. I didn't have a TV, and I didn't have a place to plug it in if I had had a TV. And so I went to a lot of meetings, and I'm very, very grateful that I got sober when there were lots and lots of meetings. And, of course, that's one of the other great things that I'll say about Zoom is that, wow, you know, these people who are in a hospital, people who have a newborn, people, you know what I mean? It's there all the time. It's fantastic. But so I was in a meeting in my first year. And we used to have speakers sometimes. We would have a speaker every week at my home group. And the speaker would sometimes say things like, I'm going to come here and speak next year because I get asked every year to speak at this group. And next year when I come back, half of you are not going to be here. And I'd be, I always knew they meant me. I always knew they meant me, you know. And I see that fear, I actually think, served me very, very well. Because it kept me close and it kept me doing a lot of things that I needed to do. I heard somebody say something on Zoom this year that I'd never heard before, but it probably was said. And they said, don't let the life that Alcoholics Anonymous gives you take you away from Alcoholics Anonymous. And because amazing things can happen here. You know, it really does. And you've heard so many people sharing about that. So I'm in my first year, and this woman comes and she talks, and she's, I don't remember her name, and that's okay. You know, so she said, how many people in this, I'm not asking this question, I'm telling you what she said at my home group. She said, how many people in this room have read the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'm not asking the question, I'm just saying this is what she did at my home group. So I had not. And I was a little... You know, I'm superstitious about lying too much in AA, not that I haven't. But I didn't raise my hand because I had not read the entire book. And I looked around my group, and I'm going to say maybe half of them raised their hand. And I'm sorry to say this, but I know some of them were lying. But that's, you know, but okay. Now, I was going to 21 meetings a week. Most of the meetings I was going to were speaker meetings other than a book study and a step study. And so I did not know how often this woman was going to be speaking. I mean, I may have to hear her all the time. And so I guarantee you this, I said to myself, I will be able to raise my hand the next time she speaks and asks that question. And I read the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to know that as I stand here this morning, my sobriety date is July the 13th, 1972. And if I continue to do the things that I've been doing and I don't drink, on the 13th of July this year, I'll celebrate 50 continuous years of sobriety. I can't believe it. And I want you to know that no one in the last 49 years has asked how many people have read the entire Big Book. But I am ready. I have to tell you a couple other little funny things. All the years blend anymore, but somebody walked up to me and they said, I heard you when I was new. And you go, oh my gosh, they heard me when they were new and they remember something I said. You know, it's really a wow. And she said, yeah, she said, I remember you said that thing about you were over 10 years sober before you could put a dollar in the basket. And she said, I thought, what a loser. So, you never know how that's going to make a difference. And so I have to tell you this other funny story. So, 10 years sober, up until way past 10, but anyway, around 10. Oftentimes, in those early months and years of my sobriety, sometimes I would go home and I would found a $5 bill in my pocket. I never had a $5 bill. So somebody put that in my coat when I was in the bathroom or something. Then sometimes I'd come home and there'd be a bag of groceries on my porch after I got a place to live years later. And sometimes there'd be a bag of clothes. And I'd love to tell you that I was awash with gratitude that people were so kind. I was humiliated and horrified that I was such a loser that people were still having to give me stuff and that I couldn't pay my own way. Everybody else, it sounded like, by 90 days sober, they were president of some kind of a company. You know, I mean, what? You know, what step did I miss? So anyway, yesterday, this woman rushed up to me. She said, I owe you an amends. I don't even recognize her. I go, you do? And she said, yeah. And she mentions this old timer that we know from the 502 Club in Covina. And she said, I used to come over to your house. And she said, I used to steal your food. Because you'd let me take a shower. And we figured out the year. And I said, somebody else gave you that food. I said, I mean, I wish you could have found a better place to steal from. I mean, you know, I had bread and peanut butter. And she said, and later on, you know, it turns out, she said she had to make amends, and she brought back the food, so one of those bags was from Carol. And here's Carol with 43 years of sobriety, and we got a chance to... So the funniest thing anybody ever said to me was I gave a talk once back home and this guy stood in line, I think because his sponsor was behind him, told him to. And he shook my hand and he said, I want to thank you for your talk. And I said, oh, thanks. And he said, I don't really believe that was your story, but I like the way you told it. And then I thought, oh, yeah, it's only in AA that we think, you know, you're new and you're thinking they're making this stuff up to make, you know. And then they come back year after year to tell it, you know, like, really? So I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up in a home with a lot of violence. I grew up in a home with a lot of other kinds of abuse that happen in some homes, alcoholic or not. I grew up in a home with poverty, and I grew up in a home with mental illness. And by the time I was 5 years old, I needed a way out. I didn't want to be here anymore. I wasn't looking forward to anything. I could already look around. There was nothing to look forward to, just more of the same. And it was bad. And my first obsession was not with alcohol or the chemicals that I mixed it with. My first obsession from the time that I was 5 years old was with suicide. And I began from the time that I was 5 years old, I began to actively think about, look for, or try different ways to kill myself. And as my drinking and my life progressed, I began to put myself in a position where other people might take my life. And I prayed to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. I need out. I need a way out. And I love finding out many years later that they originally thought of naming the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, The Way Out. Because, boy, this has definitely proven a way out, you know, for me. And isn't it great that we have a book? Sorry, here's one of my squirrels. But isn't it great? You know, when Bill Wilson got sober, by the way, some people are telling me that they go to coffee sometimes, and at coffee, they heard someone say, "Who's this Bill Wilson guy?" Because sometimes we forget. Like, we all know who Bill Wilson is. We've been talking about him for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. Yeah, Bill Wilson. Remember the Bill Wilson? Oh, yeah. Who is that guy? Is it someone with 60 days? Who's Bill Wilson? You know, so I think we get a chance to, like, share. So Bill Wilson was one of our co-founders. I know you all know that, but just in case, okay? So Bill Wilson, before he was a co-founder, because there wasn't anything to find, Bill Wilson, there was something to find, but he hadn't found it yet. But anyway, Bill Wilson had 6 months sober. Now, there is not an alcoholic in this room that doesn't know how long 6 months is. Wow. I mean, in some ways, it's longer than 49, you know, years. You know what I mean? That 6 months is tough. So Bill Wilson had 6 months sober, and he met Dr. Bob. And a little, with a, you know, couple of segues there, here and there, Dr. Bob did get sober. And we establish the date of Alcoholics Anonymous as the date that both of them were sober. We had two, one alcoholic talking to another, and there's two people sober. That's the date we celebrate as the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the date Bill Wilson got sober, but the day there were two. So anyway, now when Bill Wilson gets sober and they start working with other people, Bill Wilson had 6 months. We didn't have a book. We didn't have steps. We certainly didn't have traditions. We didn't have pamphlets. We had Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, pretty much. And then we, you know, started to grow a little bit. Well, as people were getting sober, they looked at Bill Wilson with 6 months. Now, Bill had this nervous stomach. And so Bill had an ulcer. He had a lot of problems. So Bill drank sauerkraut and tomato juice because that kind of soothed his stomach. Now, they didn't know if there was something in the sauerkraut and tomato juice that was helping Bill have 6 months. So when you were new in 1935, they gave you sauerkraut and tomato juice. So aren't you grateful we have a book? So, from that age of five, I began to, like I said, I began to cut my fingers and hands and wrists with razor blades. I began to burn myself and beat my body and do a lot of different kinds of things. And, you know, I am not a psychologist or psychiatrist. I don't have any professional training in that way at all. I have seen professionals, not as many as lots of other people in this room, but I've seen some. I don't have any kind of a diagnosis that, to give you, although I'm sure that these were, at least some of them, were probably well-meaning professionals. But I felt about those people kind of like a friend of mine, Patty Hicks, always did, and I thought those people should have to work for their money. And I never told them anything. I never filled out any forms. I never answered any questions. I never played with any of their dolls. I just sat there, I looked at them for however many minutes they wanted to keep me in there, and then I got up and I left. So obviously these people were not capable of helping me, even if they would have liked to. Growing up, the first thing that I wanted to be, if I couldn't die, or I was continually trying to die anyway, was I wanted to be a boy. Because in my life, my mom was a bar drinker, and she drank in very violent bars. But in my life, before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not remember ever seeing a man cry. And in my life, I've seen men shot, I've seen them stabbed, seen them arrested, I've seen their kids overdose, I've seen their wives leave them. I've seen a lot. I never remember, doesn't mean it's true, but I don't ever remember seeing a man cry. And I believed, until long after I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe that's because men don't feel pain. They only feel anger. That's how I wanted to be. I wanted to only feel anger because I felt so much pain. And I learned in my life, again, I'm not, you know, this isn't a professional theory, but I look back and in hindsight, it seems to me like the way I live my life is I would much rather you punch me in my face than hurt my feelings. And you have to take it from me, I was very good at getting people to want to and to actually punch me in my face. So, you know, I started to drink when I was 8 years old on a regular basis. I had already been using other kind of chemicals for almost a year. I was continually on a day-to-day basis asking God to not let me wake up and to please let me die and to let me out. And so I have to tell you, I'm as grateful for alcohol as I am for Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not have made it out there. I needed it. And I am so grateful that I'm one of the rare people that gets the reaction that I got because I needed it. In finding out I couldn't be a boy, I sat about, you know, trying to get the closest thing. And the way I saw the world, I'm from Venice Beach, California. It's a beach town. It's in California, so there's pretty nice weather. You know, it's very important that you have bare feet. Tough broads have to have tough feet. And it was very important to me that I could put lit cigarette butts out with my feet while strangers were watching me. And sometimes they'd whisper back and forth, and I used to think they were saying things like, "Wow, that is a tough broad." And I was very impressed I could show them these kinds of things. And after I'd been sober a while, my sponsor said, "Maybe what some of those people were saying to one another was, 'Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire.'" You know, but I didn't know there was another way of looking at it, you know. And so to be in that neighborhood, for me, the only option, if I couldn't be a boy, was to be a tough broad. And I spent as much time as I possibly could trying to be a tough broad. I never made it on the inside, but I tried. I hung out with tough broads. I tried to look tough. I practiced my look, you know. I did a lot of fighting. I like to always mention I have never won a fight in my life, but I have never fought less than 5 people at a time. And that's just kind of the way it was, you know. So my mother, from the time I was pretty young, began to come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I kind of knew it was here. I was in and out of living with my mom or foster homes or running away or, you know, whatever was going on. And those foster homes, you know, people used to, you know, like they would say, "Oh my gosh, you were in foster homes." It's like, oh, I was so lucky. Those foster homes were like a respite. You know what I mean? It was a break from the insanity. And I'm so grateful to those families that took me in. And I was not an easy foster kid. I really disrupted their lives. I was very, very, very damaged. My mom brought me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have an exciting drunkalog, by the way. Everything I did, I drank. I've never said anything like, "No, thank you, I've had enough." I don't think that ever crossed my mind to say. I don't think I ever drank without getting drunk. After I'd been drinking for a while, I found a combination, which was barbiturates or downers or reds or yellows or whatever you might know them as. And that combination with alcohol got me where I wanted to go, which was out. I didn't want to care about you and I didn't want to care about me. I'm not a party girl. I wasn't having fun. I know that's not the story. You know, we are people who normally would not mix here. There are some party animals who had some fun years of drinking in here. That wasn't me. I threw up. I blacked out. I overdosed. You know. It's not that exciting. So my mother brought me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was coming back. She brought me because she thought if she left me alone, I might throw a party and get her evicted from another apartment. I came into that meeting. I did not raise my hand. I was not an alcoholic. And even if I had been, I would not have joined an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. Because I blamed her for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. And the short version, a lot had gone wrong. But the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began for me that night, even though I didn't get sober. It began because there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anyone. anybody else in the whole world. And I know a lot of you might not identify with this, but that's why we're people who normally would not mix. The guy in that meeting that night was a drinking pal of my mother's. He drank in those really violent bars that my mom drank in. But he won the fights. My mom was like me. She lost every fight she ever fought in, although she only fought men who were 100 pounds more, weighed more, 100 pounds more than she ever did. You know, Paul won fights. He'd just gotten out of jail. He had a knife with him at the meeting. And I looked at him and I thought, you know, if you've accomplished all of that, why would you need to go to AA? I mean, if I could have told you the one thing I wanted, if I had to be alive, if I had to keep living, the only thing I wanted was I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Well, when you're 87 pounds, it almost never happens. But I'd seen Paul win those fights, you know. So I got drunk the next night. And then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still didn't raise my hand. And I talked to Paul, and I explained to Paul in between the meetings all the reasons I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't anything like my mother, who was an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic. I had my whole life ahead of me. I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I was not alcoholic. I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. And, of course, you later find out non-alcoholics never spend any time trying to convince other people they're not alcoholics. I didn't know that. And so Paul turned to me and he said, June, I'm new in AA. And they told me I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink and I've seen the way that you use chemicals. And I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets. You're going to be selling your ass and you're going to be shooting stuff. And I knew he wasn't trying to make up a story like the teacher in high school might do about, just make up some weird, crazy stuff. He was talking about things that were happening or had happened in my life and had happened in his. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. I could not believe it could be that bad. And yet, in those next 2 weeks, every option but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. My mother and I had a violent relationship. We had had a violent relationship between her drinking and mine. She was getting sober, and she told me she didn't think she had to be subjected to any kind of violence in her apartment. She asked me to leave, and I did. And the rest of my family hadn't had anything to do with me for a while, and I was actually about 5 years sober before I was invited back to family events. I'd been in a number of foster homes. None of them would take me back. There were back then just a couple of, sober livings or rehabilitation. We didn't call them all that back then, but there were a couple. I contacted the ones that I knew about. I knew about three, I think. I contacted them, and none of them would take me. Some because of my age, and some just because of my attitude. And I thought, well, you know what? Who cares? Who cares about programs? Who cares about foster homes and family? None of that really matters. If you're a tough broad from Venice Beach, the only thing that really counts is your gang. Excuse me. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself 87 pounds, black eye, swollen lip, no shoes. Wouldn't have worn them if I'd had them. No money, no job, no place to live. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I raised my hand. And I know today that there were some people in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I certainly did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous because I went to a meeting where my mother had been in and out of that meeting for 7 or 8 years. So people knew her and they knew who I was and they knew how old I was. And I raised my hand and some of the people came up to me afterwards and said they didn't want a little kid in their meeting while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back that they would get together and ask me to leave. And I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous had a third tradition that said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I know they didn't know that either. And I just thought AA didn't want me either. And I didn't want me either. I had it for as long as I could remember. So I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I'd been using since I'd found out about it. I went over to a friend of my mother's house. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at any home I ever visited. I went in there, found enough of the kind of pills I needed to take to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it. And then I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to that meeting, I could not stand, I could not sit, I could not talk, although they did call on me. And they recognized that I needed to be in a hospital right away. And I came to, and a doctor explained that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart, and had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I cannot tell you exactly why that overdose was any different than the many, many, many overdoses I inflicted upon myself. I just know that it was, because since that time, I have not taken anything that affects me from the neck up. And that's how I personally define sobriety. And as I said, my sobriety date's the 13th of July, 1972. Now, I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from the very, very beginning. I have stayed active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the years that I've been sober, but in many different ways. You know, like Debbie was saying, there's so many ways to not get bored. And there's so many ways and reasons that things need to be flexible and change as our lives evolve and change, you know. And I'm so grateful that we have all those different many ways to be of service. So I got active. You know, I love in Alcoholics Anonymous that we just give out commitments, and we do not necessarily pick the best candidate. There's a meeting in Westwood, California. I'm trying to think if anybody here has ever been. Maybe Carol might have been. Oh, okay, a couple people, yeah. So there's a meeting, it was called the 2 plus 2 group in Westwood, and it was kind of fancy. You know, people kind of dress. I didn't dress. I wore T-shirts that most people would find extremely offensive, including myself today. I didn't wear shoes. I had just been beaten up by my own gang. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I wore chains, one on my wrist, one on my ankle. I had a jacket, and on the back it said, "Do unto others and then split," which was my own spiritual philosophy. I smoked when I got sober, which almost everybody seemed to. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. It wasn't necessarily that I was smoking, but I had something lit in my hand to make sure nobody got very close. After I'd been sober a very short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and a pipe, because that also seemed to keep people away. I had a very limited vocabulary when I got here. Consisted largely of profanity. There were a few exceptions. The and mother. So found some people in Alcoholics Anonymous were uncomfortable with that kind of language, and I used it if they got too close. And they made me the greeter. So I would stand there barefoot, my motorcycle chain and jacket, black eye, swollen lip, and cigar, shaking hands with the new people as they came to AA. Sometimes I'd hear the person who brought them say something like, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can you can end up like that." And the people who didn't know me or who I was that time, they were guessing my age at 37. And as I stood at the door, if you looked at my birth certificate, would have told you I was 13 years old. If you'd asked me, I would have told you I was 1,000. So one of those things where it says in the book, you will be amazed before you are halfway through, is as I stand here this morning, getting close to 50 years sober, you got to figure, even if you're as bad at math as I still am, if she was 13 then, and then she's been sober almost 50 years, and then you add those things together, then that's even older than the 37 that they were guessing that she was when she came to AA, and that would all be true. I am. But the amazing thing is I feel younger today than I did when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. By hundreds of years. It's pretty incredible. And you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember we had an old timer named Clint Hodges, and he used to say, just work the steps. practice these principles. The steps don't know who's working them. Because I really thought it's not going to work for me. You know, I really didn't believe that it would for years. I never thought I was going to make it. I never thought it would work. I never thought I'd not feel 1,000 years old. And yet there was hope here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got hope. And for me, I got the hope from the speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I couldn't do hugs. And I didn't want to hold hands. I didn't want to sit too close to people. But I could hear that they would talk about coming here at a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And then they would talk about how their life had been transformed, how they'd had that psychic transformation, how they'd had their spiritual experience. And it was different. All of them were different. But that somewhere along the line, they got to this point where they could look at themselves in the mirror, or they could walk on the sunny side of the street. I knew that wasn't going to ever happen for me. No. But I did think maybe one day, if I'm walking down a street and I happen to look in a storefront window where you can see yourself reflected, because that's as close to ever looking in a mirror as I planned to do, that maybe I won't feel like throwing up anymore. And that was enough hope that it could maybe get that much better. You know, I want to tell you a couple of little stories about, you know, me and my life and, you know, that kind of thing. So the first conference I ever went to was the Southern California Convention. And I was 4 months sober, and I sat in, there were like 3,000 people, and I wish I was exaggerating, but I think there really were 3,000 people. I mean, going to 3,000 people ever, you know. I didn't want people to get near me. I didn't want anybody to touch me. I just sat like in the back of this giant room on the floor, you know. But I actually remember the Sunday morning speaker. And there's a picture of her. I think it's on that side. Wynne Laws. And her story is Freedom from Bondage. You know, and I got to stand in line and thank her. And you can get a copy of, you know, Bluey's probably got a copy of those that tape, possibly, you know. And then someone told me her story was in the big book, and it was my favorite story already, you know what I mean? And it just was like coming to life a little bit. So the next conference I went to, my home group, was a young people's conference. Now, I think that, you know, okay, so I was too old for young people. I felt that I was way too old. I felt so old. I felt so uncomfortable. They seemed so happy, and, you know, they were like, oh, I don't know, should I kiss him? I'm like, oh, I cannot. I can't even. You know, this is not, it's not going to work here. But I got dragged to a young people's convention when I was 11 months sober, almost a year. And it was in San Francisco. Now, I grew up in Venice, and I had run away once to Culver City, which was 7 miles east. And that's as far as I'd ever been when I got sober. You know, we didn't have a car. You know, there weren't a lot of things happening, you know. So San Francisco, it was like an 8-hour drive. And I think there were, you know, 20 people in the car. You know how that is. Because we, you know, I don't even know. I don't think they had seatbelts or whatever. Anyway, they dragged us, you know, dragged me to this convention. We pulled up at this convention. It was at a hotel. Now, I haven't been back there, but other people have verified that I'm not totally crazy. This hotel is called the St. Francis Hotel. Now, my mom, being an alcoholic, we lived in a lot of motels. But I had never seen anything like what I saw at the St. Francis Hotel. We pulled up, and these people, the men, they were opening the door. They were wearing top hats. There were women inside with long dresses. It was daytime, you know. I mean, the fabric was these, I mean, giant windows with red velvet drapes, gold everywhere. So we pulled up, and the people I was with, they go, you know, let's go in. I go, I'm not going in there. Absolutely not going in there. I was not even wearing shoes on a regular basis, you know. And it took this group that I was with, it took them a while to talk me into going into that hotel. And I snuck in that hotel kind of through the back stairway. I went into the room. It's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever been to in all these years that I didn't go to one meeting. I could not. I knew if they saw me, they'd come over and they'd go, come on. Can you look around here? This is a place for decent people. We can't have somebody like you. You're from Venice, right? I mean, I just, you know, I couldn't do it. And I didn't want to embarrass my friends, and I didn't want that conversation. And I snuck out and went down the fire escape, and I went walking around, and weirdly enough, and someone else verified that this is true, that hotel's fairly close to Skid Row. So I found myself walking around on Skid Row, and I was pretty comfortable. But I must have been wearing a badge, you know, because, you know, they give us these badges. I don't know. I was walking around, and I met Bobby, who's from Atlanta. Bobby S., who later on went on to be, you know, on the committee there, and who's from Atlanta. Oh, yeah, you know Bobby, too. Yeah. So, you know, and Bobby was about as uncomfortable as I was. I don't know if one of us had a couple of months. He probably had a year, more than me, or maybe he'd already had his year. And we walked around, and so I still was hanging out with, you know, a little bit of fellowship, but I couldn't do the whole, you know, be around people kind of a thing. And then I want to, I'm going to fast forward to 7 years later. I'm at the Palm Springs Roundup. And this was a big deal in my neighborhood. There were, again, frequently 3,000 people. And people dressed up there in Palm Springs in June, hot, just in case you don't know this, because, you know, I might not have known, very hot. People dressed up, they wore furs sometimes. I'm not kidding, even though it was 100. I mean, they were wearing their sobriety, and people just looked fantastic. And my sponsor, Gail Wilson, happened to be on that committee and had been for many, many years. And because she was on that committee, I went to the conference. But she usually helped pay for a room for me. She always gave me a job so that they would give me a badge. And this particular night, I'm 7 years sober. Someone had given me a dress to wear. Someone had bought me a banquet ticket, because I never could have paid $20 or whatever it was. And I was sitting there at the banquet comparing myself to everyone else in the room, something I still do on days when I want to make myself feel bad. Because I talk to myself, you know. And so I'll look across the room and I saw this woman wearing this gorgeous black dress. And I go, wow, don't you wish you were wearing that black dress? I said, no. I go, what do you mean, no? I go, no, I like this brown dress that I'm wearing. I go, okay, wait a minute. Don't you wish you were wearing something green? You know, like that gorgeous color that Sonia's wearing? That's your favorite color. Don't you wish you were wearing something like that? I thought, well, no, it's really, really beautiful, but I'm glad I'm wearing this brown dress. Then I started asking myself more questions. I did not want to have curly hair. I did not want to be from Venice. I didn't wish I had your mom. I didn't wish I was at the fun table. You know the fun table, where they are. I'm over here at the loser table. They're at the fun table. I never get to sit at the fun table. And then the most incredible thing happened for me. Because at that moment, I wanted to feel exactly like I felt. I had never had that. I didn't have it before I was drinking. When I was drinking, I was not feeling anything, so I don't know if that quite counts, you know. And I'm sad to say it took me that long in sobriety that I was 7 years, because I know some people it does go a lot faster. But I didn't want to be anybody else. I didn't want to trade places with anybody else. I couldn't believe it. And I am telling you, when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first generation members that were here were so incredibly persuasive, and there wasn't one of them put together that could have told me when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and I just had that, you know, thing where I can't even come outside in a lobby of a fancy hotel. Hey, June, you keep doing this thing? You keep trying to apply these principles? You keep showing up? You don't drink no matter what? And one day, you're going to not want to trade places with anybody. That was impossible. Impossible. I would never have believed them. And, you know, for those of you who are new, who are thinking, you know, 50 years sober, I mean, I can't believe it either. And I want you to know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if the old timers here had said to me, June, if you go back in those streets and you continue to drink the way that you were drinking and live the way that you were living, we promise you, we guarantee you, you will be dead in 6 months. We guarantee it. I'd have run out and kept drinking. I wasn't afraid of dying. I couldn't go on living the way that I was living anymore. I couldn't hate myself any more than I did when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, this is a progressive disease. And I've mentioned, you know, that my mom went in and out for 40 years. I watched, after periods of sobriety, alcoholism come rushing in so fast you'd swear. You'd swear somebody made it up. And those of us who have stayed sober here, we've seen that happen with people that we care about. So that's telling me I have 5 minutes. So please stay. I hope one of the most important things that you could ever get out of this conference, hearing this, all of these speakers, I guess if there was one thing I could wish for you, it's that you saw that every single one of us talked about making mistakes, screwing up, forgetting to call our sponsor till after, after the house was on fire. You know, I think most of us have done all of that. We've not worked a step perfectly. We haven't done all the things that we know we should do sometimes or whatever. We've lost our sparkle. You know, it happens to every single one of us. And so I hope that the most important thing I'd like to say to you is you don't have to drink to start over. Please, you know, don't drink no matter what. And if you don't drink no matter what and you stay close to Alcoholics Anonymous, in my experience, you will get uncomfortable enough that hopefully you will be willing to ask for help. And I'll tell you, sometimes it doesn't seem to have gotten any easier for me over the years to ask for help. Again, that ego comes back, you know, at times. You know, but I am quicker. I don't like to be uncomfortable. You know, I'm going to tell you one more story, I think, and then I'm going to fill it finish with this one other thing I want to read. So, when I was 2.5 years sober, I'm not sure, something like that, I was going out with somebody, believe it or not. And we'd been going out for 2 years. And we never made it 30 days without him breaking up with me. And most of the time when he came back, then he would make amends for sleeping with my friends. So that was, he was really working the program. He never took me to dinner. He never bought me a present. But I loved him. So my sponsor didn't really like him. I know you're going to find that hard to believe. But so he broke up with me again. And this time, you know, you can only do that like so many times. The pain, because I'm a deep feeler. And I was feeling a lot of this pain. And, you know, I don't like pain. And I never learned how to feel pain out there. That's what alcohol was for. And I was really, just 2.5 years sober, this was a lot of pain. And so I don't want to drink. I'm not going to drink no matter what. But I think, well, I have to kill myself then. I mean, that was always my backup plan. So I was sitting there and I was thinking, I could kill myself. And then there was a knock at the door. Oh, I forgot to tell you this other part about him. Just, you know, it sounds like I'm talking about him, but I'm really not. We would go to meetings, and he would go in 15 minutes before me, and I wasn't supposed to say hi, because he didn't want anybody to know we were together. And then sometimes we'd be driving somewhere, and he'd see somebody he knew, and he'd say, duck! And I would duck, so nobody would see me. And I just felt so lucky that he was dating me at all. I'm not kidding, you know. So, now it's been, you know, he's broken up with me again, and I can't live without him, I think. So, because I do a lot of thinking. And I think I'm going to have to kill myself. And there's a knock at the door. So I go to the door. There's this guy named Bob. I go, hi, Bob. He goes, hi. He goes, you remember we're supposed to go to that panel tonight. You know, central office asked to take that panel over to the city college. And I go, oh, Bob, experience, strength, and hope. I just don't have. I was just going to kill myself. And he said, have you had dinner? I said, no. He said, well, I'll tell you what, come with me. We'll go get some dinner. We'll go to the panel. I'll bring you back and then you can kill yourself. I said, okay. Now, we got in the car, and I wouldn't let him really talk to me, you know, because I don't want to get distracted from the pain. And you can't really turn the radio on because the wrong kind of music might come on. You need the right kind of music. You know, you got to be thinking about the pain. And just in case any of you are not sure about this, if you want to feel maximum pain, you cannot just feel the pain of a broken heart. You must concentrate on the fact that there will never be anyone ever again. Or you haven't gotten to as much pain as you can get. So I was working on this, and I couldn't have him distracting me. It's deep in my pain. So we went to dinner. I don't know if I ate or talked or anything. And we got to the meeting, the school, where we were going to carry this message, you know, with a panel from Central Office about Alcoholics Anonymous. And we get out of the car, and this woman walks up to us, but speaks to me. She goes, "Do you know where Building C is?" I go, "Nope." I give very short answers when I'm in pain because I don't want to have a conversation. So she said, "Well, could you help me find it?" I thought, well, fine. I mean, I've never been here either. So we wandered around getting lost. And she was very chatty. Rock it on. She said, "I'm taking a business class." I go, "That's good." "So what kind of class are you taking?" I go, "I'm not really taking a class." She goes, "Well, what are you doing here?" And I go, "Well, I came with some people. You know, we're a little panel. I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, alcoholism." She said, "Really? For it or against it?" Well, I don't know, you know. So she said, "I'm on the wagon." And I said, "That's great." I said, "I've known a lot of people on the wagon. Sometimes they fall off, but I said, that's great." She said, "Why would you be giving that kind of a talk?" And I said, "Because I'm an alcoholic. And I stay sober one day at a time through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime?" She said, "Yes." And we traded phone numbers. Obviously, I couldn't go home and kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. So I met her the next day, took her to a meeting, went to some meetings. She was in and out a tiny bit for a while. But in August, Kay will celebrate 47 wow. Continuous years. And the thing is that Kay has every bit as much to do with the fact that I am standing here sober as I had anything to do with her staying sober. It talks about in our chapter, working with others, when all else fails, I'm paraphrasing, try working with another alcoholic. I hadn't remembered that, but kind of like Christine said the other day, my feet were taut. The guy showed up, I'd made a commitment, I went. I didn't like it, I didn't want to go, I didn't think it was going to make any difference. I didn't like them. I didn't like her. I didn't want to help her. But I just, you know. And so it's a lot more, you know, Chuck C. would talk about, we can't think our way into right living. We have to live our way into right thinking. I have had a psychic transformation. It has been incredibly slow in my case. It talks about, you know, in the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening. My spirit was almost dead when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was boarded up with boards, like all over my spirit. And slowly through the years in Alcoholics Anonymous, some of the boards came down. Then I got those heavy drapes, you know. And then eventually, slowly throughout that, you know, period of time, sometimes I got to sort of the wispy drapes, you know. And sometimes I have none. I can just see right clear through to the sunlight of the spirit, you know. But I need people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need all of you. I need to stay active. And I want to read you, for me, what is my favorite, one of my favorite things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I will sit down if I can get my phone to work. So I mentioned that we had two founders originally. And the second one was Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob died in 1950, right after the International Convention in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is his talk. It's not very long. Don't panic. I'll try and read fast. Okay. My good friends in AA and of AA, I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this, with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say I've been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength hasn't returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. There are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member, the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to do numerous little kind and thoughtful acts in our behalf. So let us never get such a degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to extend to our less fortunate brothers and sisters that help which has been so beneficial to us. Thank you, Lee, and thank you all for letting me be part of your weekend.
Give Jean and all our speakers another hand.